to Mercy real far.
I've already said that if you wanted to cook anything, you had to go to such lengths as getting all these little chips of wood and that sort of thing and making your own cooking appliances. Well, now, when it came to keeping yourself clean and washing and bathing and dobing, washing your clothes, put it that way, down in the farther end of the camp was a sort of lean-to building, about 40 feet long, I suppose, and through this lean-to building ran a galvanised pipe about 2 inches in diameter. And about every 18 inches along this galvanised pipe on the side was drilled a hole about a quarter of an inch in diameter. And at certain times during the day, the water would be turned on. You had to fill up your dixies or whatever you'd got to keep water in and get your bath done and get your clothes washed and that sort of thing. And it was cold water. Well, this was all right in the summer when the sun was shining and it was boiling hot and everything else. But in the winter, silly damn Matlows like us, we used to go down to this outhouse and take our baths. We used to be blue with cold, as can well be imagined, when the temperature was round about 40 or 50 degrees, under a little tiny jet, a quarter of an inch in diameter, of cold water. But we had been trained and we wanted to keep ourselves clean. So we did it, come what may. In fact, I even bathed down there when we had snow on one or two occasions. So from that point of view, it wasn't very good. But we managed. Now, at one period in the camp, there was a typhoid scare. And the Italian medics decided that everybody would have to be injected with a typhoid serum. So we were carted off down to the place which they used as a sick bay, lined up in front of the Italian doctor to get our injections. It was in the summer. We had no shirts or anything on, just shorts and clogs. And I arrived. Oh, before that, I'd noticed that a lot of chaps in front of me, they kept passing out. And I couldn't understand this. I mean, an injection was nothing to be feared or anything like that. We'd had plenty of them in the service. However, they kept passing out. I understood the reason why when I got up in front of the Italian doctor who was doing the injections. For a start, he was cross-eyed.
Literally?
Yes. And secondly, the injection was put into the left breast. He just threw the hypodermic in your left breast. Well, now, when you appear before a chap with a hypodermic in his hand and he's cross-eyed, he's probably looking at your right breast. All of a sudden, a flaming hypodermic lands up in your left breast. And this is what was making people heel over. They were bracing themselves on the starboard side and caught it up in the port side. However, we came away from there with our injections and over the next couple of days, her left breast started to swell up so that you looked like half man and half woman. So what I and several others did was get a couple of handkerchiefs and make a sort of half bra, because walking or running around with one breast the size of a woman's and the other one the normal size, it hurt. So that's what we had to do.
So you made a kind of cup for
that's
it?
That's right, yes. Made a cup for it.
You were saying about how, maintaining the Navy tradition, you kept yourselves very clean, but did this prevent you getting lice in the event?
Yes, it did.
So
I can't remember of any case of our ship's company getting lice. We kept ourselves spotlessly clean, as we had been taught to do, and as best we could under the circumstances in which we found ourselves. I think that before we finish on this particular aspect of POW life in Italy, I ought to mention that the rations that we got from the Italians was roughly 396 grams daily of food from the Italians, which is just slightly over 3/4 of a pound. And they also, from their largesse, gave us 5 Italian cigarettes per day. I don't think that there is anything further which I can enlarge on the Italian side.
Well, perhaps I could ask you one or two
yes,
things.
Yes, please do.
You said that you got all these delicacies, as it were, in the Red Cross parcels. Mm. Did you use any of those to trade with or bribe guards?
Not in Italy, no. But what we did do, every day, every time that Red Cross parcels were served out, between two of the huts in the compound, we used to hold a market, which was purely and simply bartering one sort of food for another. And after a time, if you became very expert at it, you could make yourself almost another half parcel of food by judicious bartering, like dried prunes for a tin of sardines, or a tin of herrings in tomato sauce for a tin of Nestle's milk. All these things were like the stock exchange. They had a value which was quoted, and it went up and down right throughout the day and from week to week. So you played a sort of stock market, and thereby you could increase the value of your Red Cross parcel. This is what we used to do. And this used to go on for hours after the parcels had been served out from the store. We used to spend hours just going up and down, bartering one with the other to try and increase the value of the food that we got.
Did this fluctuation in the exchange rate result in any racketeering?
No, I wouldn't go so far as to say there was any racketeering, no. It was a plain, straightforward swap, and the best man won. If you were, like on the stock exchange, a good accountant, you could make money. If you were a good barter in a prison camp, or in that one in particular, you could make food. It was as simple as that. But that's what used to go on.
You mentioned the Italian girl with whom your colleague made contact. Was it common for POWs to have contact with Italian civilians?
No. No, it wasn't. In this particular place, which was virtually out in the sticks, really, there was very little opportunity to make contacts with civilians. And it was not like Germany, which we'll talk about later on, where you had big working parties going out. There were very few working parties taken out from this camp in Italy, and then they were not taken on a regular basis, not by any manner of means, only when they were required. And it was only a comparatively small camp, really, of 3,500, and a large proportion of them were NCOs, that is, in army language, sergeants and above, and in naval language, petty officers and above, who under the Geneva Convention weren't allowed to work anyway. So it didn't leave an awful lot who the Italians could call on for working parties.
How would you describe the relationship of you and your fellow POWs with the Italian guards?
Well, the Italian guards to us were one long laugh. They really were. They were dead scared for a start. None of them had any interest in the war. They were a scruffy lot. And when I say scruffy, I mean scruffy. They were not smart as you'd expect an English serviceman to be, even on a job like that. And every night at roll call, they used to come marching in with their bugle band. And I've never forgotten the tune that they played on their bugles. But they used to look so funny.
What was the tune, by the way?
Oh, you want me to sing it, don't you?
Please, yes, go on.
Ta 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 ta. That's how it went. And they used to just amble along. There was nothing smart about them at all. The big trouble, as far as guards was concerned, was the Italian Carabinieri, which, as you probably realise, is part military and part police. They were the big fly in the ointment. And if they caught you doing anything, or caught you with a knife, they would take you down to the Carabinieri quarters and give you a good beating up. I saw an RAF sergeant come back from there one day. They'd had a raid and discovered he'd got a knife. They marched him away to the Carabinieri headquarters and beat him up. And two of the instruments they used for beating up was take off the clogs, the wooden clogs that we had, bang their rifle butts on your feet. And the other thing was using broom handles to beat you across the head and the back, or anywhere else that they could get a broomstick to hit you. And this poor chap came back bruised, bleeding, cuts, in a shocking state. But this is the way they used to do it. It was the Carabinieri that was the big fly in the ointment. The rest of the guards, as I say, were just to laugh, really.
Could you tell who were fascists and who weren't?
Well, no, I don't think I can. I don't think I can say that. We never sort of investigated this angle of it. It didn't interest us. Certainly, the Carabinieri seemed to be on Il Duce's side. The poor little guards, they couldn't have cared less, I don't think. There was one other type of Italian military man for whom we had a great regard. They were nice chaps. And they were the Alpini Regiment. They really were nice fellows.
In what way?
Educated, well-spoken. And they had some concern for you. We didn't meet a lot of them, but when we did, we noticed that there was a vast difference between the Alpinis and the other Italians.
What brought them into contact with you?
I'm just trying to remember, and you know I can't remember what brought them into contact with us. As I say, there weren't very many of them, but I can't for the life of me remember why they should have been there.
No, man, it's all right. You've mentioned the discipline which was imposed on that sergeant by the Carabinieri, but what about discipline as it was imposed amongst yourselves by your NCOs? How did they keep discipline in the camp?
Well, really, in that particular camp, the NCOs didn't discipline us in any way. All the discipline was contained in the sort of hut leader, the chap, say the regimental sergeant major in charge of a hut. Well, we never had one in ours. And we didn't suffer from any indiscipline in any way. But with the army bodies, where the huts were full of army bodies, then they did have either a staff sergeant or an RSM in charge of them. And as I didn't visit the army huts at all or get involved very much with them, I don't know how they impose their discipline, you see. But certainly as far as my own hut was concerned, which comprised of us Matlows, some RAF people, some South Africans and some Afrikaners, we never had very much bother in this respect. I mean, I mentioned that time that I went to town and had a fight with Pinkerton, but apart from that, I can't remember any other incidents that happened in our particular hut.
So was there any formal organisation at all in your hut? Was there a committee or
no,
anything like that?
No.
Or did you have a spokesman through whom you would speak to the Italians?
No, all we had was a canteen representative who used to take orders for the canteen. In our hut, we were well off in this respect. In our hut was an RAF sergeant who, in civvy life, was a shipping clerk and could speak fluent Italian. So when we wanted anything from the Italians or to find out anything from them, this chap by the name of Bevan, he was a Welshman, he used to talk to them just as I'm talking to you. And, you know, we got all the information that we needed this way.
Well, what was this canteen from which you took orders?
Well, under the Geneva Convention, and you've probably seen something in the papers recently about POW's back pay. Have you?
Yes.
Mm. Well, this is all mixed up with it, you see, because camp money was issued to all prisoners of war in Italy, and they were allowed 10 lira a week. And with that 10 lira, they could go down to the Italian canteen where they sold fruit and wine and razor blades and writing materials and, Pudinas, they were called, but which were virtually what we know as instant whips, which we could make little puddings out of, you see, to supplement our rations, and likewise buying fruit to supplement our rations. And we used to have a canteen representative in each hut, because with 3,500 men, they couldn't all go down to a small hut with a canteen in it. So you had one man take the orders for the hut, and he would go and get what they'd ordered and bring it back. So we don't, you see. That's what the idea was, and that's how it used to work.
I think you were going to say some more about the fan blowers that you invented.
Oh, yes. Well, cooking apparatus. Mm. When we first went there, we obviously had nothing on which to cook the things which we got in the Red Cross parcels. So we had to go into the tin bashing trade, that is, get empty tins and knock them into some sort of stove. Well, we had no hammers, but you could find the odd nail, which you could use for riveting. And by devious means, various people had acquired scissors over a period of time. So you got these tins and you took them down to the washing outhouse for the better calling it a better name. You washed them, cleaned them, took them back, borrowed a pair of scissors, cut the tin into the shapes that you wanted, got your nail and a bit of stone, and riveted the various pieces of tin together and formed them into a stove. Well, the first ones that were made just fitted a Dixie, like that. They were just straight up and down stoves with a little firebox at the bottom. Quite a simple thing.
Like a cylinder.
Hmm. But made into the shape of a Dixie, because the Dixie was straight over there and like that, you see. So it was an arc, one side. Then, that was very primitive, of course. Then, some of them came in from North Africa and they got gas capes with them. So someone hit on the idea of making a similar sort of stove, but with a pipe leading into the firebox and a gas cape bellows at one end so that you could pump air in, just like a blacksmith's forge, in fact, or a pair of hand bellows. So then we made those, and this was a bit of an improvement. And then someone had the idea, well, if we got a bellows there, why can't we have one there and the firebox there? Push that down, and that goes up, and then you get a continual flow of air. You see? So we made these with double bellows. And then a New Zealander developed this idea of a fan blower, whereby you made the firebox and the cylinder, but instead of having a pipe, just a thin pipe running into the firebox, you had a drum about 4 inches across, all made of tin, of course, and inside that drum was a fan. Put the fan in there, and then you put the outer piece of tin on. And this fan was on a spindle, and you made a framework to carry the spindle, and you put a handle on it, and when you turned the fan, you got a forced draft into your firebox. And this was the absolute top notch of cooking utensils in that camp. And as I said earlier when we were talking, you could, with charcoal, start from scratch and boil 2.5 pints of water with a fan blower in 45 seconds because the heat created was terrific from these things. It really was. And we used to hold competitions. That's how we got the timing.
Competitions for how fast
certain
volume could be boiled.
And following on from that, no, I'll leave that. We won't go any further with that at the moment. Well, we can follow on there because with these fan blowers, which I've just been talking about, we took the idea into Germany and thereby hangs another little tale, which I will talk about later.
Fine.
I think before we go on to Germany, Mr. Macy, there are one or two other things that you'd like to add about life in the Italian camps.
Yes, that's true. While we were in the Italian camps, although we got the Red Cross parcels pretty regularly, the camp was built on one side of the River Lavagna, and there was a suspension bridge to the main road. Now, periods during the winter, when we got heavy rains and storms, the suspension bridge, which was pretty fragile at the best of times, either got blown or washed away. When this happened, it took the Italians an awful long time to repair the thing and get another bridge across, with the consequence that for long periods, a matter of weeks in some cases, we didn't get any Red Cross parcels. And therefore we had to exist solely on the Italian rations, which were very inadequate. Now, at one period, we hadn't had any parcels for 6 weeks. And we were all pretty run down. And I seemed to catch it up pretty badly as far as malnutrition was concerned. You've probably seen pictures of, in newspapers and on film, television and that sort of thing, of black children in particular who had very distended stomachs and the rest of them was skin and bone. Well, this happened to me in Italy. And at this particular time, when I was suffering in this way, our ordnance artificer by the name of Cantel made a break from the camp, got away, and eventually got home. And one of the first people that he went to see when he got back to England was my wife. And the silly idiot went and told her of the condition that I was in when he had left the camp, which wasn't a good thing. Another time, I suffered, like a lot of us, very badly from boils. And at one particular period, I had 17 boils in various parts of my body. There was nothing you could do about it. As I said before, the medics there had practically nothing with which to treat you for anything. So it was no use going down the sick bay. You just had to put up with them and hope that they'd clear up soon. Another thing is about the conditions in PG-52. I've already said that we had this wishy-washy vegetable stew every day, which was part of our ration. Well, now, in the summer of 1943, when the stew came up at 11 o'clock from the cookhouse, on the top of it was a scum of little green caterpillars about 5/8 of an inch long and 1/8 of an inch thick. Obviously, the vegetables, cabbage in particular, had not been washed thoroughly in the galley. And these caterpillars were just laying on the top. Well, we took one look at this, said, ugh, threw the stuff away, wouldn't eat it. The next day the stew came up, and there were the self-same thing, caterpillars all swimming merrily on top of the stew. Well, by this time, having missed one meal, we were feeling pretty hungry. So we did the best to skim off the caterpillars and eat the rest of the stew. On the third day, up came the stew again, and there again were the caterpillars. We were still pretty hungry, so the lot went down. We ate the lot. No two ways about it. At least it was a meat ration, which was more than there was in the stew. Now, another thing is that while we were in Italy, an army sergeant by the name of Eric Huggett decided that he would like to produce the Gilbert and Sullivan light opera, The Mikado. Well, he asked the Red Cross to get him a doily cart vocal score, which was the music, and the libretto. And he waited for several months and nothing came through. So he did no more. He sat down and he wrote from memory the music and the libretto of the Mikado complete. And the bandmaster of the camp band sat down and orchestrated it from what Eric Huggett had written. The show was put on. It wasn't very well dressed. We had nothing there with which to make costumes. Kimonos were just rough, raggedy blankets. And men's hats were pieces of cardboard stapled together and such like. However, the show went on and it made a bit of entertainment. Not long after the show was finished, lo and behold, what should he receive but the libretto and vocal score of the Mikado? And it's unbelievable, But when his version and D'Oyly Carte's version were compared, the difference was very, very little when you consider that he had to write everything from memory, music and words. Now, I think that is all I can say about the chem... Oh, no, there's one more thing.